We're going to do one, two, three, record. No, baby, we're not going to clap this time. We're going to sync up our recordings like they do in the movies, like, boop, you know what I mean? Like, we're going to try to synchronize our tapings.
Uh-huh. Are we, am I going to record on three or record?
On record.
Okay.
Okay, ready? One, two, three, record.
I did it! I did it.
We're just learning so much right now. I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
This is Still Processing. Wesley, I want to read something to you just for a moment. Can I?
Oh, sure. Hit me. Hit me.
Ooh, okay. Here we go. Sometimes it takes the wisdom and resilience of those who've been marginalized for all of us to remember the importance of community and mutual aid, period. That's a tweet. Who do you think that tweet is by?
I mean, this is the part where, like, you really blow my mind right now, but I'm going to just, like, hope against hope that it's our current president, Donald J. Trump.
It's his predecessor, Barack Hussein Obama, out here in these Twitter streets, offering comfort, things that are more hearty and nourishing than my bone broth, more or less. My bone broth is pretty good, but really out here dishing up delicious servings of shouting out frontline workers and grocery store clerks. I know you've seen some of these.
I've seen some of them, and they are inspiring. I mean, I saw that he retweeted a post by a disabled activist.
Yes.
And I think it's at CripChick.
That's the one.
And, you know, he had a message basically saying, don't forget in these times who else matters. I mean, it's just, can you imagine how different things would be if, like, this is what was happening during these press briefings every day? If there was, like, we've dealt with all the important information about hand washing and protective gear and all the other crisis-oriented things. But I want to take a moment now to just talk about the people. Talk about the people who are out there on the front lines suffering and making this work. And people who are not remembering right now. That's important, too.
Right.
I think it's partially a little bit a civics lesson in that you are learning a little bit like what else a leader can do. But there are other people actually giving actual civics lessons in some way. There are people out there telling you to fill out your census form. Don't forget, amidst all this turmoil and chaos, y'all got a census form to fill out. And that's important too.
And you know who the number one advocate in New York is for taking the 2020 census, Mr. Wesley Morris?
Besides the mayor and the governor?
No. Cardi B.
New York City. 2020 is a huge opportunity to make our voice heard. This year, we have the power to decide our city's future, not just for the next 4 years, but for the next 10 by getting counted in the census. The census is about power, money, everything.
She is out here working for NYC.gov, but also hustling on her social media platforms, reminding people, y'all want to be counted. You need to be on record as existing so that we can get the social services we need. I was like fanning myself watching this public service announcement.
Thank God for Cardi B.
I also find her to be one of these unexpected and deeply important impromptu ad hoc leaders in this moment right now. There's a moment in one of her Instagrams when she talks about, you know, she's wearing a mask. Her nails are fully done, which I love. And she's talking about how disgraceful it is, frankly, that celebrities can get tested and the average person can't get tested.
And on top of that, a lot of celebrities, y'all have the luxury to pay $34,000 or whatever the fuck it costs to get tested and get treated. A lot of these people, they don't fucking have that money.
And her voice cracks when she says money. She says, people don't have money. And I felt that. And I know she felt it. Mm-hmm. Like, she remembers what it's like not to have a lot. And it's important for celebrities to not be so out there in woo-woo island. I mean, our colleague Amanda Hess had a great piece about that in the Times this week, about how out of touch they seem. And I love that Cardi B manages to be in touch as she talks about this crisis.
And then in the middle of all this, Oprah Winfrey comes back.
I know. Truly, with the talk show, specifically about COVID-19, though. She was like, the people need me.
This is a moment that we have an opportunity in the midst of all of our fears and disruption to really rise. And I know
the void is pretty big right now. And I am heartened to see a person like Oprah Winfrey step into it with her special Oprah Talks COVID-19.
Right, right.
Where she just is trying to get people through this moment, you know, talking to people on the front lines, hearing stories about people doing their jobs, listening to people talk about this experience and trying to bring them some sort of comfort.
And also demystify it for most Americans, right? Because the reason we're looking to these alternative leaders is because there hasn't been a lot of clear messaging around what's happening right now for the average person. So Oprah, you know, we're projecting a little, but Oprah presumably feels the need to step in and be a little bit of an authority because we really don't feel like we have any right now.
Right, right, right.
Meanwhile, did you see what Britney Spears posted?
No, I did not.
OMG. I don't know who sent this to her, and I don't know how she found out about it, but it was incredible. So a few days ago, in the midst of, you know, everybody spiraling out on social media and trying to figure out how to use this time and then figure out, you know, how to be productive, but then also how to rest and how to readjust their lives, homegirl Britney Spears posts this real socialist sounding manifesto that's been making the rounds through all of queer and POC Instagram. And it's a manifesto written by a queer Chinese artist who lives in Brooklyn named Mimi Zhu. And I'm just going to read a little bit of it. I'm going to read all of it, actually, because it's incredible on its own. But then just think about the fact that Britney Spears posts this. Here it goes. During this time of isolation, we need connection now more than ever. True. Call your loved ones. Write virtual love letters. Technologies like virtual communication, streaming, and broadcasting are part of our community collaboration. We will learn to kiss and hold each other through the waves of the web. We will feed each other, redistribute wealth, strike. We will understand our own importance from the places we must stay. Communion moves beyond walls. We can still be together.
I'm sorry. Did AOC write that?
Well, it's part of this whole trend of people writing platitudes and using cool graphic designs and posting them around the web, which obviously is right up my alley. I don't know why I'm speaking about it like it annoys me. It's part of a bigger wave of people doing things in the vein of artists like Jenny Holzer. And it's like coming up with the sayings we need for this time. You know, like, we're going to save ourselves. We all we got. Like, it's very much in that mindset and I'm here for it. But there's another layer to it because you think about Britney Spears, who is always under quarantine. Mm. Like, she's been living this life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like she's letting us know, like, I've figured out how to make it work under my conservatorship. Like, y'all can figure it out. Yeah. I'm like, how do we reach out and save Britney? But it also is just incredible, though, because I think it's an indicator that, you know, everyone's being impacted. Everyone's being affected. And there's a desire to let one's digital neighbor know you're not in it alone.
Right.
I'm right here beside you. And that's a really incredible thing.
All right. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a woman who owns a record shop in New York City in 2020. Hulu's High Fidelity. We'll be right back.
Wesley, you know where I stand on lots of issues, but on the issue of reboots, I don't know if we've talked about it a ton in terms of how I feel about them. Generally, I think they're terrible.
Oh.
They're always, like, not great versions of the original thing. To me, it's like eating jerk seitan.
Ooh.
Or Dippin' Dots.
Oh.
Two things I like, by the way, but I like them because I'm well aware that they are not the thing they are sort of a proxy for. That's not really jerk chicken. And it's not ice cream. But they both still taste good to me.
Well, you are speaking my language right now, though. Because we're living in a moment of high, what I can only call high reboot.
Like, oh, yeah.
You know, peak maximal reboot. I am not a fan of this. I am an originalist when it comes to popular culture. I just want you to give me the thing that you came up with that is not based on some studios or in some cases, I'm not going to name names, your parents' IP. I don't get mad at the artist level necessarily. I'm mad at the studios.
Yes, yes.
You can hire anybody to think any thought and write something new and original. But you guys have created this system where you've disincentivized artists from thinking originally. They can easily see what your library consists of, your back issues, your archives, and be like, you know what? I see that Universal, you've got this incredible old monster archive. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to take an old monster thing that you have. Or if I'm an executive, right. You know, we've got all these old monsters. Right. We should just redo them. So in the last few years, we've gotten everything from Jumanji to Westworld, Lost in Space, Boomerang, Party of Five, Dumbo, Men in Black, What Women Want Becomes What Men Want with Taraji P. Henson, live action Lion King, live action Aladdin, Charlie's Angels, which nobody wanted.
I know.
And I just feel like when you're at the Charlie's Angels point, you have kind of hit bottom. And this isn't to say that some of these reboots, remakes, sequels, rethinks, whatever you want to call them, don't have anything to say. Frequently what happens now is that you're politically correcting for an old problem. Mm-hmm. Or you're using a movie about four men to make a point about its maleness by casting four women. I'm looking at you, that needless Ghostbusters remake with all those great women. It was another example of, like, why not get those four women together to do something other than a Ghostbusters remake?
And that's why, honestly, Wesley, when you told me I should watch High Fidelity, I was like, no, I don't need, like, on top of everything else I'm going through, I don't need a crappy reboot. But turned out, like many things you tell me to do that I don't want to do, you were right. I really enjoyed the new High Fidelity. I was surprised. I had so much built up. I like sat down in a huff with my arms crossed and was like, we'll see how this goes. And then I was just like a melted popsicle on the floor by the end of the first episode.
So the show and the movie have a lot of things in common. They're both about a record store owner named Rob. Mm-hmm. The 2000 movie starred John Cusack. The 2020 television show stars Zoe Kravitz. And the movie was directed by Stephen Frears, who made Dangerous Liaisons, and he would eventually go on to make The Queen with Helen Mirren. High Fidelity is based on a Nick Hornby book. And when it came out, it was a decent hit. Basically, the two properties are about a recently dumped person in pursuit of the person who dumped them or is trying to figure out how to deal with having been dumped.
Okay. That's everything, I think.
I mean, you don't have to go this second.
I know, but I think it's best if I do, so.
Just stay for tonight.
No.
Okay, just stay for a drink then.
I don't think a drink's gonna do it, Rob.
How about two drinks?
Jesus Christ, can we just make this just a little bit easy, please?
Oh, I'm sorry, is this inconvenient for you?
You know what, I'm just gonna go, all right?
Wait, Mac.
And it's about both these characters taking us on a journey, a narrated journey through their past loves. And both Robs have new relationships.
That's a really nice way to put that they are rebounding with very sweet innocence, but go on. But go on.
In the movie, it's played by Lisa Bonet, who happens to be Zoe Kravitz's mother. And on the TV show, it's Jake Lacy, who is now American popular culture's perfect boyfriend figure. They both own a record store called Championship Vinyl that has two other employees. One is a wacky, loudmouth, obnoxious person with a lot of opinions. And the other person is a little more quiet and thoughtful about what he likes. In the movie, the loud person was played by Jack Black. And on the TV show, it's played by Divine Joy Randolph. I think the thing that makes the show great, in addition to some good writing, is Zoe Kravitz. The show does not work if she doesn't work. And she works, so the show works. I mean, this is a part that I have been waiting for her to get for a long time, where she's a star on this show. She's star.
She's so natural. So
she's
sweet.
So natural.
So charismatic.
What I love about Rob in this show is that she is enough of a character that is brought to life by writing, but is also animated by this performance. And there are all of these wonderful things that that Zoe Kravitz gets to do in terms of owning space as a performer.
Who knew Zoe Kravitz on screen would just be so effortlessly chill and funny and self-possessed and witty and charismatic? I'm thinking in particular about that scene in the very first episode after she and Clyde have their drunken hookup. So there is Zoe Kravitz sitting at her junky dining room table.
And this, ladies and gentlemen, is why you don't get back on the fucking horse.
Clutter everywhere.
Not that I needed another reminder. I have all the reminders I need.
And she's just slopping, you know, cereal into the bowl. There's Fruity Pebbles or whatever she's eating everywhere. She's slopping the milk around too, and then just shoveling, you know, spoonfuls into her mouth while she's explicating this hookup. And she's so tangible. You know, she's really projecting this self-effacing disregard that I just feel like is hard for someone as well-known and as, frankly, pretty as Zoe Kravitz to do. She's just shed basically all of her cool persona and really is putting herself out there in this incredibly vulnerable way. And I was sold. I was here for it.
I would also say this Rob is different from John Cusack's Rob in the movie. In the movie, Rob is, he's cranky. He's cantankerous. He is sexist a little bit, maybe, or like just a little bitter.
Don't underqualify that. He is a lot of all those things, not a little of those things.
Fair. This is another of John Cusack's tortured lovers people. And in this movie, I'm thinking about, you know, Lloyd Dobler, obviously. There was a kind of romance for like something that was sort of broken in him and brooding, but kind of like sweetly optimistic at the same time. He was vulnerable. He's much harder in High Fidelity, and his bitterness is this armor that keeps him from being able to maybe successfully be in a relationship.
She was nice. Nice manners, nice grades, nice looking. She was so nice, in fact, that she wouldn't let me put my hand underneath or even on top of her bra.
Attack and defense, invasion and repulsion. It was as if breasts were little pieces of property that had been unlawfully annexed by the opposite sex. They were rightfully ours, and we wanted them back. Sometimes I got so bored of trying to touch her breasts that I would try to touch her between her legs. It was like trying to borrow a dollar, getting turned down and asking for 50 grand instead. I wasn't interested in Penny's nice qualities, just breasts, and therefore she was no good to me.
Yo, I rewatched the original High Fidelity in the same period of time that I decided to watch 28 Days Later. Now, I would not advise that anyone watch 28 Days Later while you're in the midst of thinking about contracting a virus, thinking about, you know, trying to protect yourself from some pandemic. But I will tell you this, Wesley Morris. I had an easier time finishing 28 Days Later than I did High Fidelity.
Oh, Jenna, come on.
I'm being really? 100% serious. I could not take, you know, being submerged in this man's just unhappiness and his defensiveness and his insistence that, you know, things like appearance and aesthetic and, you know, all the accoutrements of life don't matter at all. The only thing that matters is having a very well-curated record shelf and a very well-curated bookshelf.
A while back, Dick Barry and I agreed that what really matters is what you like, not what you are like. Books, records, films, these things matter. Call me shallow. It's the fucking truth.
What the argument of the movie ultimately is that everybody can have opinions and that some people's opinions are better than other people's opinions, essentially.
I mean, this ideology is the thesis of everything about this man, Rob, but also everything about this movie, from the chats they have in the record store to the songs they play to all the references they drop. And it's not enough that it's just in the realm of the movie. No, I feel like it extends in a very Donnie Darko, like solar plexus worm-like way into the viewer itself. You know, if you don't agree with these ideas, if you don't think this is the best album of all time or the best top five songs of all time, then you're a loser and you don't get it. And I don't think I felt that as strongly the first time I watched it. The first time I watched it, I was really like, probably taking notes. Actually, there's probably a sad little composition notebook out there somewhere with my name on it where I was diligently taking notes on the albums I needed to listen to and the things I needed to be aware of in order to make it in the world. Because back then, my entire world was full of guys like that. Men like John Cusack, Jack Black, and then the other guy whose name I always forget, though I know you know.
Todd Luiso.
Who's so wonderful in the movie. They were taken as the ultimate gatekeepers, are just the types of people that mattered in culture and in society. And I think being very much a child of the 2000s, it's almost a little bit painful that there's no awareness or interest in any of the exciting music that's happening, whether it's Missy Elliott, Destiny's Child, who is so a thing. And I get it, like those guys would not have been into those artists necessarily, and they don't have to be. But I remember like trying to have conversations about what I thought was exciting and being shut down by guys like those guys who thought, because I didn't know the entire discography of the Smiths. I mean, the Smiths is a perfect example because it's a hill that I've had to die on many times in the course of my adult life. Many a dorm room party was shut down because I was just like, I'm not into this. And people just could not handle it, that I would just openly be like, not for me. Not for me.
Meat is murder.
Like I hear it come on and I'm like, yeah, it's fine. But it's like one of those bands that people just have such a fixation on, you know?
I'm a fixate-y.
Good. Well, you can talk me through it sometime. I would love...
I don't need to, though. You don't need to love the Smiths.
The movie made me feel like if I didn't at least have a baseline appreciation of them, then, you know, my cultural interests were moot.
Also, there's this really interesting moment where in High Fidelity, the movie, a man comes into Championship Vinyl looking for a copy of I Just Called to Say I Love You. I don't know why he's doing it. The song at that point is 16 years old. It makes no sense. But Jack Black is not having it.
What's your problem?
Do you even know your daughter? There's no way she likes that song. Oh, is she in a coma?
Oh, okay, buddy. I didn't know it was Pick on the Middle-Aged Square Guy Day. My apologies. I'll be on my way.
Bye-bye. Top five musical crimes perpetrated by Stevie Wonder in the 80s and 90s go. Sub-question, is it in fact unfair to criticize a formerly great artist for his latter-day sins? Is it better to burn out than to fade away?
Here is a guy attacking another human being for being interested in music by saying his interest in music was not worth dignifying with a record sale. Mm. And it's just like, all right, I see where you sit, Mr. Black. And I will say that I appreciate it as a critic because the show does not have a moment like this where the takes being had by any of the characters are that strong. There's nothing on the show that's as like hot takey as that.
But that's the thing about the show that makes it so fun to watch. Rob has this incredible cultivated collection of tastes and interest in music, and it's just hers. She's not trying to lord it over anyone or use it to wield power or pass judgment. And you see that the best in the interactions with her new love interest / rebound named Clyde. When they're hanging out one night, she's talking about why they're only going to be friends because he likes fish. You know, which is hilarious to me. She's like, yeah, we're just going to be friends. He's into fish. And then on their first date, they're hanging out in a bar and he's like,
Question.
Answer.
If I were to admit out loud to you right now that I truly, no joke, love this song, would you get up and leave?
Hell, I love this song.
And the song that's playing is Dreams by Fleetwood Mac. So good.
Yeah. I don't love Rumors as a whole.
And she's like, no, I like this album. She's like, but I like Tusk better, which is, you know, it's funny. Another thing that's so great about how the show uses music, it's almost like you're getting tuned into Rob's psychological jukebox. The whole first season of the show is populated with little pockets of moments where you can't really tell what is happening inside of Rob's head versus outside of her head. And I'm thinking in particular of one scene where Daydreaming by Aretha Franklin is playing. And Rob is just staring off into space. And one of her coworkers, Charisse, is trying to get her attention.
Rob, come on, what the fuck is your problem? Stay focused, go, your turn, dude.
Oh, yeah, right.
And you can't really tell if that's the song that's on in the shop or just where, what's happening for her psychologically and psychically in that moment. The show is very, very good at using music to score and punctuate the emotional transitions that this woman is going through at this very tender moment in her life. It's also a show about someone who is very self-absorbed, but not a narcissist, and someone who is interested in growth and interested in self-improvement, or at least interested in trying to understand why she's made a series of questionable, I'm not going to call them bad, but a series of questionable decisions.
You mean like treating Clyde as her personal Uber? Yeah, I mean, I think that like one of the things that's smart about the show is the way that it uses Clyde as a benchmark for her awfulness, right? Like nobody on the show gets treated worse by her than this guy. And he's the person who's most willing to put up with it because he likes her so much.
Well, I feel like that's the awareness that she comes into over the arc of the show, right? Mm-hmm, it's less about resolving her past relationships and it's more about, you know, how is she going to show up in potential new ones? There's a part of me that's just so enamored with a female protagonist who is interested in relationships, but more than being partnered, she's interested in thinking about how she is in relationship to other people, whether they're romantic interests, whether they're her friends, whether they're her
Clyde,
siblings.
Her brother. Exactly. That's what I was thinking about. There's the consciousness about what kind of relationships she's going to have with other people I'm thinking specifically about romantic relationships, but then there is this like unconscious thing that's going on with her and Charisse on the show. And Charisse, of course, is the Jack Black character on the show, and her function on the show initially is to just do Jack Black, but the way that Divine Joy Randolph would do Jack Black. And so, you know, her introduction is to come into the store, take off the great music that's already playing, and put on Dexy's Midnight Runners, Come On Eileen. Mm-hmm. You know, she's really feeling Come On Eileen.
I had a fucking dream about this shit last night.
Were you wearing the overalls?
Yeah, and what's so crazy, I was had a dream about it, and then and then I was like, yo, I gotta listen to the song. And I had to listen to it and see if I really like it, and I forgot. This song is dope as shit.
And come on. It's supposed to jar you in the sense that you wouldn't expect this to be the song that she rolls up in and says she had a dream about, puts it on, and expects everybody to just, you know, come on Eileen with her.
No, wait, hold up. Stop. What the fuck?
She's big, she's loud, she's telling people off. She is the instigator of many good conversations, by the way, about taste. She brings in this top five villains question where they sort of fill out the top five villains and then contests that Michael Corleone doesn't count as a villain because he's the protagonist of the movie. And somebody says, well, that's just an anti-hero. And she says, no, I reject the term anti-hero because that is something that somebody made up to make us think Clint Eastwood is not an asshole.
That's a great part.
Is criticism functioning at its highest level. And the idea that you have this black woman with all these opinions about art and taste and is conversant in all of these modes of being is a great thing to have on a show like this. The problem, of course, is that she also is ragingly insecure. And I don't know if you could feel it the way I could feel it, but like there's something going on with this woman that feels really deep, and the show isn't willing to unpack it.
Charisse, to me, is the most interesting character on the show, and she gets the least amount of screen time in a lot of ways. You know, I want to know how Charisse and Rob became friends. And, you know, they exist as these two Black women in this universe who have had very different life experiences just because they exist as two different people. But we never find out what Charisse's life experience is. We know that she has another job outside of the record store, but we never find out what it is. She's deeply interested in starting her own band. Like, where does that come from? We never find out. Rob's brother also takes up a pretty big chunk of the show. He gets his own episode arc as they have kind of a bachelor party because his wife's about to give birth. And so it's his last night out on the town and he gets his own segue. But Charisse, there's so many question marks. Every time she disappears off screen, you're like, what's she up to?
Where's she going?
Where's Cherry going? And they never tell us. They never tell us. But yet we know that she is deeply impacted, you know, by the world. We know that she does feel the weight of other people's projections and biases against her and what they think a woman who lives in her specific skin must be like. A perfect example of that is, you know, she puts up a sign in the record store describing herself as a front person for the band she hopes to form.
Read my motherfucking influences.
Influences must include Stevie Wonder, 66, 77. Stevie
Wonder!
James Brown, Life with the Apollo, 63, mostly side A.
Only side A.
Pumpkin Crimson, but not so Prague. Dunyan, but more Nordic. Cream, but only Ginger and Jack. Tambourine.
And then there's a moment after it goes up where this guy comes in and reads it, and he's like, oh, damn, I gotta meet her. And he asks somebody in the store, who wrote that? And they point to Charisse, and the guy takes a look at her and is like, nah, and dips out. So the implication of that scene is that this grungy-ass white dude is repulsed, okay, by the physicality of Charisse, who's a fuller figure, darker-skinned Black woman. Her experience stands in direct contrast to Rob's. Everybody knows what Zoe Kravitz looks like, but she's a very slim-bodied, fair-skinned Black woman. And, you know, there's another moment in the show where the gang is hanging out in front of one of their local watering holes and they're all very tipsy. And I think it's Simon who says, you know, get home safe. And Zoe Kravitz is like, oh, don't shoot, in this very offhand way that was like, maybe you've never known somebody who was the victim of police brutality or violence, but that is a very light-handed thing to say. And I get it within the universe of the show, but that, to me, it kind of speaks to one of the things that Rob is working with, right? Her unawareness about her own privilege as a fair-skinned Black woman.
Well, it's also important just to point out when you're talking about the difference in their complexions is, you know, these two women are bringing with them the entire history of Black women in entertainment,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
This is 250 years of American history happening in this little record store where Charisse's Ethel Waters and Pearl Bailey, and, you know, Rob is Lena Horne. And there's a constant preference for people who look like Rob and a fixed job for people who look like Charisse. And this is the sort of the pain that Divine Joy Randolph brings with her to the performance in some ways. And the bigness of her performance has these layers of these reserves of hurt and ache. But what it's missing right now is writing that makes the character make more sense. So this is where, Jenna, you and I plea with the people who make the show to, like, for season two, not only I don't just want Charisse to have her own episode, but just, I don't know who's writing the show, but I'd like a Black person to sort of focus on Charisse and her backstory and what else could be in it.
Exactly. We need to go into Charisse's home, right? We need to go into her home life. Who are her people? Who's her family? Who's she caring for? Who cares for her? Does she have a love life? But also the depth and development of her and Rob's relationship is probably one of the most graceful and compassionate and, to me, real moments of that show. You know, that's the real partnership that I'm invested in, that I think Rob kind of becomes aware over the course of the show that she needs to invest in too, her homies, not just her booze.
Right, right. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've just covered so much ground about this television show. But Wesley, we haven't talked about the actual ground of this TV show, which is our beloved city of residence, New York City, which I miss so much, right? And part of the reason we recommended the show and part of the reason I feel like we're both enjoying it so much is because it's kind of like, it's kind of like a virtual 3D tour of a place that we can't go anymore. It's been many years since I've spent hours in a bar just shooting the shit and drinking whiskey, but I want to do that now. You know, it's like, I feel like they're doing it for me.
Yeah.
They're doing the very thing that we want to be doing, which is just luxuriating in our crappy rat-filled city. You know, just don't you just miss it so much? I know I do.
I have never wanted to rub my elbows on a bar more in my entire life than I do right now. And watching this show just made that want more acute. I feel like this show deserves to be to this moment in some ways what Sex and the City was to New York City after September 11th. What is this show that's about this city going to do when the most terrible thing to happen to it changes the inhabitants' relationship to it? How is this show going to respond to that terrorist attack? Mm. And I wonder how a show like High Fidelity, is it going to try to deal with this moment? Like,
I hope
what are
not.
These characters?
No. Please
okay.
don't.
Interesting.
Please don't, because living in New York right now through this pandemic is all the worst parts of New York with none of the good. Mm. You're dealing with high rent. No. You're dealing with the daily difficulties of basic things. Like getting groceries is 10,000 times more of an ordeal than it normally is. And it's a pretty big ordeal on a day-to-day under regular circumstances in New York. So to exist in New York right now and be confined to your home, which is probably too small. There's that joke that's going around right now about like when you get into your first Brooklyn apartment and the realtor is like, you're not going to be here. Like, don't think about the square footage. You're never going to spend time here. Okay. The city is your backyard. The city is your porch. The city is your playground. We have none of that on offer right now. Like, we are literally just confined to our postage stamp sized box apartments, trying to make the most of it with family members, with roommates,
living
with partners.
In a lie.
Yeah.
Living in an actual lie.
So I don't need my escape entertainment to remind me of that fact. I want it to just be a fantasy of the city that I cannot wait to get back out into.
This show has arrived at this moment where everything that happened before a couple of weeks ago is instant nostalgia. It is instantly the past. Mm. And this sort of bygone analog format is now the setting of a show that is about a thing that we can no longer do as of a couple of weeks ago. And it automatically makes everything on it romantic.
Mm.
The touching of an album is incredibly romantic to me.
Mm.
The sitting at a bar, getting drunk with somebody and like doing your dime store philosophizing is incredibly romantic to me. And, you know, I'm not a big nostalgia person. You know, I believe that nostalgia is like history for dessert. It's like you're not really dealing with reality in some ways. You're dealing with a romance of reality. But right now, we'll take it. It's all we got.
Well, that's our show for this week. And calling all you crazy cats and kittens out there, if you tune in next week, we'll be talking about everyone's favorite, most hated, you take your pick, Netflix show Tiger King. I mean, I'm saying that half reluctantly because I feel like we kind of got bullied into it just because it's everywhere, but we're taking it on. So if you want to get caught up or not, that's what we're going to take on next week.
Oh my God. Still Processing is a product of the New York Times.
It is produced by Hans Buto and Sydney Harper.
Our editors are Sasha Weiss, Wendy Dorr, Sarah Saracen, and Lisa Tobin.
Our engineer is Jake Gorski.
Our theme music's by Kindness. It's called World Restart from the album Otherness.
And as always, you can find all of our episodes and various things at nytimes.com/stillprocessing. See you next week.
Bye.